Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Judging by the priorities of the U.S. government and media coverage, most Americans likely view the threat of radical Islam as the greatest source of terrorism in the United States today. But they would be wrong. Twice as wrong, in fact, as per the results of a new survey conducted by New America Foundation. The group tallied attacks by individuals claiming to be jihadists and compared their numbers with attacks by people espousing right-wing extremist and anti-government ideology. Since 9/11, people like Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev have killed 26 in the U.S., whereas those like Charleston shooter Dylan Roof have killed 48 people. There have been 7 instances of jihadi terror and 19 instances of right-wing terror. Joining me to parse these numbers is David Sturman, Program Associate at New America. He has a master's from Georgetown's Center for Security Studies, and his work focuses on homegrown extremism and the maintenance of New America's data sets on terrorism inside the U.S. Welcome to Uprising, David.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, how did you decide on which deadly incident to include in this data set? Did you use a definition of terrorism and then just cast a net based on that? And if so, what definition of terrorism? Because, of course, there isn't a formal consensus.
Right. So we track these incidents of extremist violence based on court documents and newspapers. We try to apply a consistent methodology that there has to be some sort of political aspect to the action or the violent incident. We don't include just what seem to be more personal hate crimes or just criminal activity. It has to be deadly for this particular tally. And it either has to have been charged as a crime or possible to charge as a crime, but have resulted in the individual's death before they could have been charged.
So any incident that had a sort of a political ideology behind it. Now, the FBI does have a definition of terrorism. And it, for example, in the latest attack in the on the Charleston church in South Carolina, at which 9 people were killed by Dylan Roof, which you include in the data set, the FBI decided that that was not a terror attack. So what's going on there?
Right. Our tally is a broader definition than the particular statutes the government has used. For example, on the jihadist side, we include Nidal Hassan, who was actually charged with a series of murder charges rather than a terrorism charge, because our focus is on that political violence and to a lesser extent on the particular law that was applied, as that's often applied inconsistently depending on what is most prosecutable and on the politics of the moment.
Hmm. Your data set also excluded the Chapel Hill shooting of 3 Muslims earlier this year in March. Why?
Right. Tallies like this are highly subjective, and we certainly encourage other people to produce different tallies. Our judgment, based on what we had been reading about the case, is that it's not clear that that incident was an act of terrorism with a political motivation for the attack itself, as opposed to that sort of more individualized hate crime. So,
right. In this case, there was, you suggested there was, because there was a little bit of a vagueness to the killer's motives, that he might have killed them over a parking ticket, that you were being a little conservative and thus excluded this particular incident?
That's part of it, but it's not just the question of whether it was a parking ticket dispute, mm-hmm. but also the question of, was there really a political motivation there, or was it a more personalized hate that was not connected to a broader political ideology or attempt to establish a politics?
So what is the common thread in the right-wing attacks? I mentioned 19 such attacks since 2001, September 11, 2001, 7 attacks in the other category of jihadi terror, quote-unquote. What is the common thread in the right-wing attacks? The Charleston shooter was clearly motivated by white supremacist ideology, but if you look at, for example, the 2009 assassination of Dr. George Tiller, that was motivated by anti-abortion beliefs, although I understand Tiller's murderer was a member of the Sovereign Citizens Movement. Is white supremacy a common thread?
So it's difficult to tell which of the threads combine in which incidents. It's one of the things that requires far more study here. There do appear to be, by what we're tracking as right-wing, consists of three separate threats. One is the white supremacist movement. One is the anti-government movement that includes both the remnants and parts of the patriot and militia movements, but also the sovereign citizen movement, individuals who are aligned with that and then take it to the level of violence. And then there's the anti-abortion extremist movement, so the Tiller, killing of Dr. Tiller case. And those three trends combine at points. At other points, they're relatively separate. And the effort to determine to what extent these are merging, diverging, is very difficult at the moment because there's not a lot of independent tracking of this type of incident when everyone is focused on the jihadist threat.
Right. So, and I want to get to that. So what about the sort of demographics of the two data sets? I tried to look through the column that tallies up right-wing incidents of terrorism, and I could only find one woman, Shauna Ford, who was involved in the attack in Arizona against a Latino man and his daughter. But I understand that, or if not all the rest, at least most of the rest are men, and almost all of the perpetrators in that column are white. Is it safe to say that that is an accurate demographic?
On the gender aspect, that's certainly safe to say, and that's something that is pretty consistent across ideologies. In our jihadist sample, we found only 21 women since 9/11 charged with jihadist terrorism crimes or who died before they could be charged, which is only a small percentage of the 290-odd people indicted. On the ethnicity, it's harder to tell, but it certainly looks like the vast majority of the right-wing or non-jihadist sample are Caucasian, whereas on the jihadist end, there's a vast diversity of ethnicities that are represented among people who have committed jihadist terrorism-related crime.
And of course, when the government puts resources into these sorts of issues and pays attention to these issues and tries to determine how to protect the public, they do rely, whether they like to admit it or not, on racial profiling. And so, you know, it's interesting to see this data set. And also they rely on certain numbers to determine where to put resources. What do you think your data set can teach the government that they might not have been paying attention to? Certainly, it seems as though the government has been paying much more attention to radical Islam than white supremacist or anti-abortion groups.
So I think, first of all, it's worth noting that though every death in these incidents is tragic, the numbers are actually quite low. So in looking at how to prevent incidents, it's important to acknowledge that there's not a white supremacist insurgency, there's not a right-wing vast insurgency in the United States. That said, it does appear that the right-wing or anti-government and white supremacist extremism has been largely ignored. Often these incidents are dismissed as lone cases, even when they do appear to have organizational aspects connected to it, which can lead people to think that they don't have to provide a tip regarding extremist activity or someone who may be taking preparations to conduct an attack, which is dismissed as that person is just crazy, not that person is on the verge of an act of extremist violence.
Now, how well known are these numbers among law enforcement, both local and federal law enforcement circles? Do police and the FBI know that the resources that are allocated to these two different types of violence are not necessarily based on reality?
It's hard to tell internally to various law enforcement offices. what the balance of attention is and how that's being treated. But it certainly appears that many local law enforcement officials do prioritize and see their biggest threat as non-jihadist terrorism. There was a survey recently of law enforcement officers that found that far and away, more of them put anti-government extremism as a more direct threat that they deal with more often than jihadist or al-Qaeda-related terrorism.
And how does generalized gun violence fit into this picture? I mean, for example, we don't, your data set didn't include James Holmes, who opened fire on the Colorado movie theater as being something motivated by right-wing ideology. He's using the mental illness defense. And yet Nidal Hassan, the army psychiatrist who shot and killed 13 people in Fort Hood in 2009, is considered a terrorist shooter, even though he had also clearly struggled with mental illness. Now, he shouted Allahu Akbar before he fired. He did have strong critiques of the war in Afghanistan. The army, as you discussed earlier, did not charge him with terrorism, but that incident did make your list, while James Holmes didn't. Both of those involved mass gun violence.
So on the Nidal Hassan case, just there, it does look like he had a pretty clear political motivation in that case, which is why we do include him. The charges were, there's a whole discussion of why he wasn't charged with terrorism, a lot having to do with the military can't really charge under a terrorism statute effectively. But on the mass shootings, that's the absolutely necessary side of discussion. We're focused on the political violence. There's an important, are important reasons why we care more about political violence, in that if you allow politically violent organizations to grow up, they can pose a much greater ability to adapt and cause sudden shifts in the threat. However, the numbers of people who are killed just by non-political gun violence are far and away higher than both jihadist and non-jihadist violence combined.
Absolutely. That is a very, very important point, and we do certainly discuss that on our program quite a bit. Were you surprised, by the way, speaking of, you know, who is determined to be a terrorist by various government agencies or not, were you surprised when the government decided not to pursue terrorism charges against Dylann Roof? Because he was very clear about his political motivations in his killings. He chose his targets extremely carefully. He made, you know, on a website, clearly stated what his goal was and what he was, motivated him politically and ideologically.
Right. I think in the case of Dylann Roof, it certainly appears from what we know of the case and the alleged attacker that this fits the definition of terrorism that's widely used by scholars and the government pretty clearly. Now, the question of what you actually charge someone with is somewhat different. There's a whole level of questions of, do you actually need that to get the high sentence? Will you be able to prove it in a court? So there's a set of questions there that are somewhat different. In addition, I think it should be noted that there's still some question of whether the government may charge Roof with a terrorism.
Right, that door is still open.
Right, and it has in other cases come back later to add terrorism enhancements to simple murder charges.
And certainly even, you know, the use of the word terrorism is a political issue, whether, you know, if we set aside the legal aspects of using that term, it does have a political impact on the public at large and the public's perceptions, which is why a study like yours, I think, is so important, because it puts the reality of what we're seeing into perspective. Now, on the issue of the rise of right-wing supremacist and anti-government militias and ideology, I noticed that 16 out of the 19 right-wing terror attacks in your data set took place in 2009 or after, which may be linked to the election of President Barack Obama?
That's one possible interpretation, but our numbers there are really not sufficient to draw any conclusions on that point. There's a large issue of how often things are reported, whether there's underreporting. There's a variety of other potential causes for how these can how incidents can rise or fall, law enforcement pressure, other political winds. There's a very large debate regarding whether right-wing extremist movements, militia movements, other groups are actually rising at the moment or falling or staying the same. And really, that's something that there just needs to be far more data. But unfortunately, with the focus on the jihadist threat, there's been a far less focus on other threats that may rise.
Right, and we've been hearing news of the KKK recruiting or attempting to recruit people to join their hate fest with flyers in various parts of the country, various cities in the country as well. But their aspirations may not necessarily translate into actual numbers and recruits, right?
Right, there's always the question of both to what extent are these organizations as the organization itself involved in the violence as opposed to individuals who may have links back to it or may even be highly critical of the organization. But also, how real is an organization that's engaged in flyering? Is that a couple of people or is that a well-developed organization? And that's a question that really there's very little data on at the moment.
Finally, David, does the government need to be keeping track of exactly what you're keeping track of and using, you know, formal definitions to accurately figure out what really is a threat or what kind of ideology or movement really is a threat in the country?
I think it's absolutely essential that the government be collecting various numbers on these types of threats and looking at it. There's a very big question of to what extent the government should be involved in tracking it on an ideological basis. And that's something that needs to be taken very carefully. The government tends to prefer to focus on particular incidents, rightfully so, since everyone has a right to be extreme. It's one of the most precious rights that makes America what America is. So it's important not to invalidate that. On the other hand, different ideologies and different groups of people need to be treated the same, and there should be one standard for similar types of attacks, not one standard for jihadist violence, regardless of the level of the threat, and one standard for everyone else.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website where people can explore this data set in detail themselves.
You can find our data on this and a variety of other aspects at securitydata.newamerica.net.
securitydata.newamerica.net, and New America's own website is newamerica.org. We'll post those links to our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
My guest, David Sturman, is a program associate at New America and has a master's from Georgetown's Center for Security Studies. His work focuses on homegrown extremism and the maintenance of New America's data sets on terrorism inside the United States. This is Uprising. We're going to take a short break. Later in the hour, Darja Mail will join us to discuss the Supreme Court's ruling on the EPA's regulation of mercury emissions. And after the short break, we'll hear the next part in our ongoing series from the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum, this time featuring Noam Chomsky. Stay tuned.